Thanks for listening to Art and Family, or as I like to say in Dutch, tussen kunst en kind. My name is Myrthe Berendsen, and I'm a writer, artist, and policy advisor. In this podcast, I speak to idealists about family, for anyone questioning the status quo and wanting change, from the art world to the nuclear family, and from patriarchy to ableism, fleshing out the friction between concepts of private, personal, and public political life. In a time of doxing and political hijacking of identity and emancipation movements, this is Between Art and Family. Today, I'm going to talk to one of my favorite artists of all time, the French Camille Henrot. 10 years ago, in 2013, she received the prestigious Silver Lion Award at the Venice Biennial for her groundbreaking film Grosse Fatigue. Over the past decade, she has showcased her art in major cities and institutions. For example, in 2017, she was granted a carte blanche to take over the Palais de Tokyo in Paris. And in 2021, during the installation of her exhibition Mother Tongue at the Kästner Gesellschaft in Hanover, in Germany, Henrot began writing a series of columns titled Milky Ways for the Swiss magazine République. These columns delved into the complexities of maternal ambivalence and the challenges faced by artist parents. The series of columns resulted in the book Milky Ways that came out recently. And in her foreword, she writes that my hope is that one day motherhood will no longer refer to a fixed identity determined by gender, health, and reproductive and economic ability to care, but rather a way of moving through the world. Please join me in welcoming Camille Henrot. Welcome, Camille. Thank you so much for joining me today from your studio in New York. I wanted to start with a question of your series of columns titled Milky Ways for the Swiss magazine Republic, resulting in the publication of a book with the same title in the fall of 2023 with a German Hutsche Kanz Verlag. The book is delving into the complexities of maternal ambivalence and the challenges faced by artist parents. And while it might not be unusual for a woman to write about pregnancy and motherhood, to do so as a prominent artist and intellectual figure was a bold and perhaps unprecedented step, especially within the confines of the art world. And I was wondering, were you worried about addressing these topics in your work to delve right into the questions?
Yeah, I was worried. And that worry and that fear was very much translated into the process of writing the book, because I was invited by this Swiss magazine called Republic, which is a bit like the Swiss New Yorker. And they wanted to have a sort of like a personal tone, and they wanted it to be a bit autobiographical. And I felt that was really difficult for me to speak freely about my own experience or integrate element about myself, personal element, because I was really worried that it would sound anecdotal. It seems to me that a lot of like reason why discourse around motherhood, but in general also discourse from women, not just around motherhood, like also discourse about specific women issue, have been dismissed as anecdotal or as personal, even though we are actually a larger group of the human population. But I think the patriarchal culture has been putting this category of speech into a category where it can never reach the universal and the political, and also where it's often dismissed as looked at pejoratively. So yeah, I was afraid, and I very often try to hide myself behind other writers, other artists, and also concepts. And the more I could step away from experience and a personal tone, the more I was happy. But that created a bit of a tension, because Antje Stahl, who was my writer friend, the one who invited me originally at Republic, she really was interested in the introduction of the personal as well. And so this is why I think those columns in a way are a bit atypical, because they have this tension.
I was wondering, you made a series of work called A System of Attachment, which you started in 2018, I think. And I think it was in Hattie Judah's book that you had to repeatedly ask, especially to the press or like that all biographical elements mentioning your own child within that series of work would be removed from the discussion of the work or the like the discourse around the work. That is before you started writing the column for the Republique.
I think it was after, and it was also, it was before and it was after too. When I trust the person who's writing, I agree that it would be mentioned. When I don't trust the person who's writing, I like to have control over that information. Because I know that in the past, it's been used against women. And if you have an article, for example, that starts by saying, oh, Camiro just had a child, it doesn't have absolutely the same impact as if the article like ask question and say, oh, this work is about the pre-verbal and it's addressing the way we think about the world before we learn how to speak. These are very different introduction. And one of the first articles that was written by Art Basel on this series, System Attachment, was starting, you know, with a very personal information, just starting by saying I just had a child. And I thought that was very misleading because society has a tendency in the past historically to consider autobiographical element of artist women as the main key and the main explanation for their work. And that has been a reason to push them aside, the art history narrative, and to diminish their input. And so I didn't want it to be diminished into just autobiographical narrative because the work has much more implications than just me having a child.
Yeah, I understand. And I was also wondering in that regard, do you feel to a certain degree that you have gained control over the narrative in the past years?
It's difficult to say. I think it's better, but it's not so much because of me. I think it's because a lot of other writers, other women artists, also the idea of gender is being challenged. And I think in a way that helps feminism and by extension that helps also the perception of motherhood. I think the whole idea of like parenting and care has been gaining a lot of traction in the art world, even though sometimes a bit shallow. But I think that all of this movement helps into an understanding of the topic of young childhood or childhood trauma or care for small children, tenderness, pregnancy, the biological, what's inside our body. All of this thematic are kind of connected, right? And they are now reaching a little bit out of the box. I felt motherhood, it's funny, it's a lapsus. Yeah, I felt motherhood was a hoax in a way. And it was a box. It was a box that was very narrow. And it was actually a cage. And I actually started to have a big disgust for that word.
I was wondering like what you mean with sometimes the conversation or the discourse around it is very like shallow. And I think I agree with you, but what do you mean by that?
I'm thinking specifically more about like recent project I saw, which are titled like Care Something or About Care, where there is like a demand for attention to care. And it does feel a bit shallow sometimes because I think that it's also coming more as a, like a discourse and it's not really followed by, you know, concrete action. I've witnessed, for example, myself, many iterations of speaking about this project, Milky Ways, or showing it, and the institution absolutely not respecting my schedule of as a human being, you know, who have to take care of children or, you know, not proposing a fee for the nanny, not making it easy for me to travel to install with my family. So I guess it's okay because that's the way things start. That's just what I want to say.
I think like also my next question goes into that a little bit. You're showing the Sweet Days of Discipline in the museums in Switzerland, the title based on the 1989 book of Fleur Yeghi. Among other things, the exhibition is about outsourced care from nannies to dog walkers, from daycare to cleaners. And I was wondering, can you tell a little bit more about that exhibition and how it came about?
It was a little bit actually from like this situation of Mozone being a box, and no matter how you destroy, you know, the archetype, sometimes the archetype gets stronger, you know. The more you address it, the more you deconstruct it, the more you undo it, then you reinforce it somehow. You weaken it, but you also reinforce it. And then I was looking at my own life also, to be honest, and I was like, nothing I could do without my nanny. And then I also remember the nanny from when I was a child. And I read this text of Paul B. Preciado when she's also talking about her girlfriend coming to visit her nanny in Spain and the childhood of her girlfriend being with this very strong connection with the nanny because the mother was an academic. And Paul B. Preciado is talking about the fact that we need to honor our nanny. And I thought it's a really strong point because it's not only it's true, but also it's a way to really expand the discourse around care in a way that actually is not vague and is more concrete, you know, like care workers, people whose job is to care. And I thought it's a very blind spot. Like I thought I'd never seen a sculpture of a nanny. And I started to try to collect painting of nannies. I actually wanted to include a chapter about nannies in Milky Ways. And I realized that was such a huge blind shop that actually I think this should be a book. That's why I didn't put it in Milky Ways, because it was like a thread that bring too much element with it. Then it becomes more like I thought this will be a show as a start. And there was this prince called Working Hours where I used contract of nannies. I did a little like tour online and see like different example. And also I used a book called Nanny Makes Three, which I thought was a very good book about the dynamic within a family with the nanny. And also there's lots of testimony from care worker and their experience. Obviously there's lots of connection with post-colonial problematic and racism. It also brings question around education and soft labor and the value of soft labor, obviously class. I think it's really interesting to understand why this job is so undervalued. And Silvia Federici, also in the Caliban and the Witch, is I think a very good input on that. There's also a book called Black Oedipus, which is very interesting and strong, which is talking about the intrication between racism and care work and sexism.
Because also going back on that, like, of course, care work takes on many forms and it's overwhelmingly performed by women and marginalized groups throughout history, like Federici is already pointing out in the work that you made specifically for the exhibition called My Nanny. And I was wondering, how do you look at that work in the context of class and care that you're also writing about?
I mean, that is the text I was planning to write for Milky Ways that I didn't end up being able to put because it was a bit like, as I said, it was kind of like opening too many other threads and it was connecting to every single other chapter of the books in a way that felt really difficult to synthesize. I still have this regret that I should have written this text. I mean, if I had written the text, which is what I'm trying to say in my answer, I think it's interesting to think about this idea of class, gender, race has category that very young children are aware, like quite young. I think at 4, they already are able to recognize them and they have integrated some of the prejudice around class, gender, and race. It's very heartbreaking. Even in the most progressive family, I'm sure a lot of parents would agree that school, the environment is so strong. This sort of like heartbreaking acknowledgement that we cannot change the world around us and our children will integrate some of this prejudice. I saw that in a way, in the relationship with the nanny, like our nanny, the nanny of my children, I noticed that like there was a sort of in-between, like it's work, but there's also a lot of love and a lot of tenderness. And like trying to understand that relationship made me, I think in a more like a precise way about the work of care because it was detached from me. It was not my work. Also, I could see my nanny take care of my own children. I remember actually there's a painter who made a really beautiful painting of her nanny with her child. And I remember art historian saying like she actually did a lot of those portraits. And it's really interesting because you can tell she has a lot of tenderness for the nanny. And there is this sort of like, who's watching, what you also say, watching a child. And then you're watching the nanny watching the child. And there is a sort of like interesting, you know, Russian doll aspect of it. But also, I think as a mother, and this becomes a little bit like more like psychoanalytical, but, you know, we all need to be mothered a little bit. And I noticed that in the relationship with the nanny of my children, there was also sort of like, she would mother me a little bit, but also sometimes I would also mother her. And I think, I guess that's something we, like woman friendship is very much like that too, or even with co-worker, of course. But I thought there was also something quite interesting in this sort of like dynamic, you know, between us, and also the way I was reminded because of that experience, I started to think about the nanny who took care of me as a child, the babysitter, all the different type of care worker. I felt the topic was so much more complex, and it was as complex as childhood and childcare itself, because also the ramification with the colonization and the post-colonial movement, the ramification with the capitalist economic system.
I was wondering, like, not every mother, artist, person has access to outsourced care, or even like as an artist has your reach or visibility or power or access to nannies, to resources, to even ask for museums or institutions to have that sort of resources in place. So I was wondering how, if we look at these sort of care issues within the art world on a larger scale, how do you think institutions can make a difference for artists that are also happen to be parents, basically, and take better care of the people they're working with?
It's true. The reason why I talk about it is because I know I'm talking from a privileged position. So I have, in a way, the possibility to talk. A lot of artists who are less visible, less recognized, who have less resources, not only don't have access to nannies and to childcare, but also wouldn't take the risk to ask an institution to pay for a nanny, or wouldn't even be able to embark into the conversation. A lot of artists I know also don't say they have children because they worry it will impact people's interest. I've seen it myself, actually, multiple times.
That it would impact their career, you mean?
Yes, yes, there is people that definitely are turned off when you say that. I feel like, I mean, I have this opportunity, this chance. A lot of institutions are interested in showing my works. I have a voice. So I'm using it so that other people around me can also have that freedom. I feel like if artists who are in position of power, so to say, I mean, I don't believe artists have any power, especially right now. I mean, we all witnessed how powerless artists are, but the little power we have, I think it's good to use it to open the way a little bit for others. To reply to your question in more concrete terms, Etty Juda wrote a really good book, which is called How to Not Exclude Artist Parents. And I think she really covered that topic very well. So I would say that from my experience and the experience of my friends, a flexibility around dates is something really that helps a lot. Sometimes it's actually just having empathy, you know, like just having, not bullying people into deadlines or into not imposing your own calendar, you know, making sure it's a calendar made in agreement. And that goes also for time to meet, deadlines, everything. Then I would say also anticipating the artist can come to installation with his family. Because, you know, when you have small children, it's difficult to be away for more than a week. But you also want to be there to install and for the press and to talk and to do workshop and to meet with the journalist. So having the possibility to stay longer and to stay in an environment where you can stay with a family and a nanny, because obviously nobody can put just the partner in a position to be a full-time nanny for 2 weeks. Like even the most free and kind partner in the world, woman or man, cannot be a full-time nanny for 2 weeks. So obviously you need a solution for childcare. But there is countries where naturally they would propose that. In Norway or in Australia, they propose it right away. When I was supposed to travel to Australia, I was pregnant. They didn't even ask me. They booked a business. And my hope is actually by asking and having being a bit demanding and a bit of pain in the ass, I'm hoping that people will not need to ask. Because the people who dare to ask are always the people who can have the luxury to ask. And then all the other people who will never ask because they are afraid. And I want to be demanding for those people after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so thank you so much also for, I don't know, being the pain in the ass for the rest of us, basically. I was wondering, do you have some sort of best experiences that you can share besides booking a great flight and have your nanny come with you? Like, have you experienced institutions or museums where you're like, oh, that's a very sort of family-friendly approach of either exhibition making or openings? Or do you have some sort of best practices or worst?
I don't have one institution in mind because they all had positive and negatives, but I do remember one install where the director of the museum was very interested in the kids and the kids were very interested in him. And basically my kid was constantly in his arm while we were hanging and discussing and just sharing, you know, the tenderness for the kid and not considering the kid as like a disturbance made the whole install really nice, because I wouldn't have this moment where I feel guilty the kid is screaming or running, because it was just completely integrated. We were both having fun all together, you know, installing the show. And then in the end, there was an institution also in Belgium where they rented a house and Airbnb, and they helped me with the research of the house. And we found a house that belonged to a family who had children same age as mine. And so it was perfect because it was toys, it was, you know, changing table. And it was a big house, so I could come with my mom to help. And I also had my nanny to come. So it was kind of like a really comfortable setting. I remember that was really easy because there was somebody to cook, somebody to shop, somebody to take care of the kids. I was covered, like I could just do my work and be with the kids in the evening. And I guess it's very nice. And what makes the experience very nice is when you feel the institution or the people completely accept you as a parent and they don't see your children as something that will suck your time or distract you, and they just integrate it.
But like on a very practical level, like this all basically is about finances and also like who's paying for what. Like, is the museum or the institution able to have a nanny come over?
Yes.
A nice Airbnb or a nice hotel to cover. Is this something that you sort of talk about beforehand, that you say like, I need this and this and this and this?
Yes.
So I need, like, the museum needs to make room for, I don't know, like another 10K or for extra expenses, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a budget. And as you said, it's very often actually it's 10K because I calculated it. Other museums have asked me, even museum I don't work with, like, oh, what do you think? And I think it's not a big amount of money.
It's also for a big show. It's basically a small price of the productional costs.
Yeah, for a solo show, in the overall budget of a solo show, a big solo show is not undoable. Obviously, I will never ask that. A small institution that is fundraising for each show and is a collective.
Sure.
I think a lot of institutions can do that and they can even do more. If you think about the big institutions, they definitely have that budget. Also, there's also it's a need that they would have, to, you know, like it's the same for people with a disability or people who don't speak English, they would have to take a translator. I think this battle expands to the battle of like everything that's not like, you know.
Ableism, you mean?
Yeah, or? Yeah. But then also, you know, like language, yeah, able. Mm-hmm. I feel like the art world has been opening the speech a lot around the question of diversity, representation. And now comes the moment where we want to see that impacted into the practice of collaborating with the museum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's true. It's also like I am hearing impaired. I now, like I have two hearing aids. So for me, for example, it's easy to have an interpreter at a talk or whatever. But like what's often more an issue that I don't have a babysitter or I don't have, you know, it's like, okay, there's an interpreter. Okay, or there's technical solutions. But the main issue is like, what do I do with the kids when I have to give a lecture in the evening or something?
Mm.
It's something that's, like the inclusiveness of the art world is only, it's very limited
it's
in
very
that
limited.
Sense. Where also motherhood or parenthood is an inherent sort of able or ableist sort of confirmation.
But I think it's a very interesting topic in, because there's a contradiction that you just pointed out, that in a way, having children is an ability and it's conceived as a privilege because there's lots of people who cannot biologically or cannot because they don't have the opportunity. And now, like in the younger generation, a lot of people cannot because financially it's a luxury and a privilege to have children. But then this privilege is being, you know, played against ourselves as, okay, because you have this privilege, then, you know, you cannot ask for more. Where actually, in practical term, having a child in everyday life, it's not a disability, but yeah, it complicates things. You need more assistance. And this idea of like needs, assistance, and privilege are intricated in a very complex way when it comes to childcare.
I totally agree. And I think it's also like it's another issue in a very patriarchal capitalist system where the sole responsibility for rearing the children is with the parents, foremost the mother. But then you should raise the children as successful workers for the economy to benefit a system that you don't benefit from as a mother.
Exactly.
Anyway, I wanted to touch on that a little bit because as discussed, like there's in recent years, there's more attention to the role and the representation of motherhood within the arts. But fatherhood, especially as a subject of male artists, is virtually absent. Sure, we know the absent, abusive father, the smoking, gambling, drinking, oblique father, who's emotionally unapproachable. And I noticed that I kept looking for any artworks about the early days of fatherhood, about the caring father of a baby, about the fear, about the transformation from autonomous being to present father. And the result for me was very meager. Well, in my private life, I see fathers, and some of them also artists, struggling equally with a new role and responsibility of being a father and a family member. And I was wondering how you see this absence of paternal representation, or if you see this differently and I'm just not looking in the right direction.
No. I think you. I totally agree with you. As I was another totally blind spot, actually, of the book, Milky Ways, that I felt like, oh, I should talk more about my husband or about like maybe it's reinforcing the cliche that women have to take care of children, that it's just me writing this book because it's a labor we are doing together. But yeah, that's one of the other problems of talking about motherhood in a way, and is that there's not enough talk and conversation about fatherhood as well. Also, I think because the problem of the fatherhood conversation and everything that's related to father have been so instrumentalized politically as like, you know, nationalism, ancestor, fatherland, this whole idea of the right, it's been so heavy. It's difficult to engage with it, but it does need to be engaged with. I mean, it's funny when you think about image of a father, I think about the picture of, it's actually a female artist, Talia Chetrit, but she photographed her husband with the baby. In the picture of Talia Chetrit, there is her husband very often. And I found this representation really interesting. And even though it's a female point of view, of course, but I like the space she's giving to her husband in her work around the topic of parenthood.
Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking like, I feel like there's a lot of women I talk to about this subject keep on saying that it's important to address the role of the father more and more. Like we're doing it right now. So we're making that space even, like we're even caring for the representation of the father.
Yeah, you're right.
If like basically those fathers are not claiming the space or they don't feel the necessity.
But I think we do need to give them. I was just thinking that my husband is in a lot of my paintings around in the system of attachments, there's lots of images where actually it's him, but you can't really recognize him. And there's also images where it's me, but but it looks like a man. And I remember actually there was an old woman who kind of asked me very aggressively when she saw the paintings in Oslo at the Munch Museum. She was like, why did you paint this horrible monster man eating the baby? And I was like, but who are you talking about? And she was showing me the drawing. I was like, ah, it's me, he was my child. No, it was me, but she thought it was a man. People are so used to see woman in a positive role next to a child and men in a negative role next to a child. Like there's too much bad dad and too much good mother. And I think when the representation shifts where there is more bad, then the good dad can come as well. You know, like they are invited to the party. They just need to come.
Yeah. I was also wondering in that, like how you perceive your older series of work from 2015, like Bad Dad and Beyond, in which you explore basically the archetype of the abusive absent father in that regard, which is also long before this series of work and children came in physical form into your life. How do you look at that series?
Yeah, actually, I've been thinking about it more and more recently because I think this series also came in the political context, which was the 2016 election in the US where Trump was candidate. And at that time, because I did this work in 2015, I was very convinced he would never get elected. For me, it was really the Autumn of the Patriarch, you know, like he was encapsulating everything that I considered was the past. And he was very much a sort of like bad dad, you know, the narcissistic, pervert, libidinous, egocentrical figure. And then I was also thinking about the rage, you know, and this feeling of powerlessness with politics and how it echoed the feeling of powerlessness we had as children, how nightmarish in a way being a child is, because you have so little control and so little power, you're so fragile. And so it came a little bit from that sort of association that in a way institutions are supposed to be good, but they are always slightly abusive, like the police, the justice system, our government. And we have high expectation from them, but we're constantly deceived, constantly feeling powerless. And then the way this feeling of powerlessness manifests, it sometimes, you know, I reactivate feeling from childhood, feeling of injustice, childhood trauma, basically. So I wanted to make that connection between childhood trauma and politics and activism and social expectation.
In Milky Way, you write that in times of crisis, we tend to idealize the home as a space of refuge. And it's not just a home, but it's also the nuclear family as a setup in that. And I was wondering, like, the family, the home, it's an absent subject in art history, seen as such a sort of natural system that we don't really question the systemic injustices and implications behind that construct. And if we look at the home as a place of refuge that you're also addressing to, although statistically it's the most dangerous place to be, foremost for women and mothers and children, if we address the maternal absence and the lack of representation, shouldn't we talk about the patriarchal institution that makes us mother, as Adrienne Rich also puts it, like the family or the nuclear family in that sense? Also, statistically, the home is one of the most dangerous places to be. The highest chance of being killed is at your home as a woman.
Also sexual attacks and rapes.
Yeah. And I was wondering, the most of the abuse is taking place in the home among, you know, yes, the people we trust and that we care about. And I was, maybe I'm not really asking something, but for me, I felt like during my own personal process of writing and like focusing a lot on motherhood and then try keep on looking for fathers and a representation of fathers. And I was like, where do they come together? Where do they live?
It is the number one place where especially women and children get subjected to violence and get killed. And then still, despite the very, very high level of domestic violence and incest and child abuse, I mean, the numbers in France are mind-blowing. I dedicated a chapter of my books about it, like one little girl in five, one little boy in eight. So it's really still a question, why is domestic violence not taken seriously as a problem of our society? Why child abuse is not taken seriously as a problem of our society? I mean, this is a question I ask myself every day. Because, for example, we in Spain had a huge number of domestic violence, managed to bring the number down 46%. Like, there is a solution. We know the solution. We know what to do. It's a decision that is made on the highest level not to do anything against domestic violence. Why are they not doing anything? I think it's their answer is because they feel they don't have to, because they feel it's private, because they still feel like what's inside the house is outside of the political reach. They still believe somehow that a wife belongs to her husband. These ideas of the old nuclear family have very, very deep roots. And the work to uproot them and to deconstruct them, it's still in process, I think. But also, there's also difficulty for women to get mobilized around those topics, to formulate demands, just because I think, I mean, there's multiple reasons for that. One of them is the disparity of us as a category in terms of class and race. Another problem is the fact that we, being the underdog of society, we constantly struggle with lack of resource and lack of time. And I think the moment you all those topics are hot in your head, it's the moment where you have small children. It's the moment where you don't have time. You hardly have time to take care of yourself. Like, I don't remember last time I went to the doctor for me.
Yeah. And this is in a situation even that you do have a nanny. and you do have the resources, but still, yeah.
Yes, still, because it's just so much to do.
And also going to the doctor is not a luxury.
I mean, in the US it is.
Yeah, that's true. I wanted to touch upon that because in your foreword of your book, Milky Way, you write that another motivation for writing this book is that opening discussions on these topics could serve to inform part of an alternative political approach to how we live and grow together. Mothers do not have to reinforce old systems. They can rather inspire new models of care, resistance, and innovations. And I was wondering, what you mean by that? And what terms of living forms can I practically think about? Like, what do we need to let go of? And what can we inspire?
I think, you were saying father needs to take their space. Why are we letting them space? And I said, we do need to let them in, we need to open the door.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's true that biologically the connection with the children, they were inside our bodies. They are our heartbeat is the heartbeat they've been hearing for 9 months. Our smell is the most sweet for them, or voice, there have been a lot of studies about the feminine voice mm-hmm. on small children, also with animals. We are equipped as women in a way that men can become, but maybe it's true that there is a number of biological element that makes the connection with the children more intense at the beginning. But then later, of course, this is just the beginning, because the children need change with time. So I think what's important is to let go.
Yeah.
And in a way, the nanny helps also for that. If you can, I think the experience of having a nanny is also, having a nanny can also be, having a friend who can nanny for you, or having a sister or aunt or grandmother. This is the way society was working before.
Mm-hmm.
There was the expectation that mothers take care of their own children is very new. It's come really from the 19th century. Before, children were raised by a group of people that was helping out. It was never, ever supposed to be the sole responsibility of mothers.
But isn't also that the nuclear family, the fantasy of the nuclear family also killed the village, basically?
Yeah, and I think the village was maybe a problem for capitalist society in the way that the village is a very strong community of people who are giving each other help for no money. So it's escaping the capitalist society, the village. It's the village that serve to raise a child. Often the village is not paid to do so. It's a community, or maybe they are, but it's you offer a meal. It's not paid in it's not tax.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the nanny are often paid in black. It's difficult to change these habits of consider this work a service, between friends or between neighbors. I think that's trying to reconnect with what we had before, where we would share the children more. And children is not a property. Also reevaluating the teacher, reevaluating the possibility that extended family can take of your children. So it's trust also.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when I say let go, this is because in a way, sometimes I feel like the women who are working and have a relationship with motherhood that is a bit more critical are sometimes victim of the women who have decided not to work and have a very intense investment into motherhood. And there's a sort of cross judgment between the two. I've witnessed it a lot when I was in Berlin. It's not at all in France. It's not at all in the US. But I felt for example, in Germany, it was strong and it was painful. And it was something that was dividing the possibility for alliance between women.
Growing up, there were not many mother figures or images or books or films that I could identify with. So after becoming a mother, there was this void, this sort of representational void. And I often think of my daughters and her identity markers. And she now has Camille Henrot's work, but there's also Tala Madani or Carolyn Walker, and there's bad moms, and there's moms that are just fucking it up and shitting it and making beautiful things along the way, amongst many others. I was wondering, have you found mother figures with whom you can identify, or did you create them for yourself?
No, I have many. First of all, Moira Davey in The Mother Reader, I think, was a huge inspiration and really helped me. I remember when I started to read this book, I thought, oh my God, why did I not read it before I had a child? Because so much of my identity crisis and problems were written and were already analyzed by all these women in the book.
Yeah.
Plus, it's just a wonderful topic for writing. And there was, in the artist, there was, of course, Louise Bourgeois. And Louise Bourgeois Diary also, And there is Alice Neal also was a huge inspiration. Maria Lasning didn't have children, but she was tormented by the thoughts of having children, which makes her a mother in a way. And I was very much inspired by her work. Like I'm reading right now, her autobiography. And Jenny Holzer also wrote about it and made artwork that are really interesting about it. Even though there has been a lot of show about motherhood, I still feel like we need way more shows and way more books and way more talks because the topic is so rich. Also, because it's so muddy and a little bit disgusting and is also complex and ambivalent, it has all the wits, you know, to be actually a really good topic. Oh, yes. And I forgot to say Maggie Nelson. Because Maggie Nelson also very much wrote about why is motherhood a blind spot of culture while death is such a focus and sex is such a focus.
I think I was so happy that you also addressed the topic of death a lot within the book. Before this whole episode in my life, I was writing a lot about death because I feel it's something that's so that we can't really live if we don't talk more about death. Combined with motherhood is a sort of complete taboo subject. Like death should not be among small children. And
this is also something I talked in the book a little bit. There is a chapter about death, which I felt was very important because I had a miscarriage in between my two children. And also my whole pregnancy was surrounded by fear of death in the sense that I have bone problems and then having a children endanger me. And I'm sure it endanger any woman actually, especially women of color. So I felt really interested by that topic of death. And I learned through my doctor, actually my gynecologist, she said that the main cause of death for women between 30 and 38 is actually suicide. And it's because of the postpartum depression. So suicide is the number one cause of death for a young mother. And it's actually quite frequent. It's something that is completely hidden. Nobody talks about it.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that. Yeah.
It's very taboo. My great-grandmother committed suicide, postpartum depression. And my grandfather also committed suicide, probably also connected with the trauma of his mother committing suicide. This idea of death is everywhere where birth is. And there's the question of miscarriage is also like such a big topic. I would have liked to write more about it. Miscarriage, and it's such a messy territory.
So messy, but also I think also the act of giving birth is also, you need to die a little bit. I feel like also birthing, it's like the closest you can come to death while being very alive, like while multiplying at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that I feel with the experience of pregnancy and birth, you're reminded of trauma of your childhood. You live through them again. I noticed that as well. And this is actually the main reason for postpartum depression. And that's a very complicated. It's another blind angle around those questions. It's not something that is very much explored or very much talked about, even though it is, from a narrative point of view, a very, very interesting stories. I guess it's also because the experience of giving birth itself is so different from one woman to another. And it's also difficult to return to. Like, it's not always easy to tell that story. I think when it just happened, you want to tell it to everybody, even people who don't want to listen to it. And then once it's a bit far away, you bury that really, really, really deep. And you're like, please don't talk to me about that anymore, ever.
Thank you so much for your time and openness in this conversation and your work in general.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious to see what's next.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. It means a lot. For more episodes of this podcast and to find out more about my upcoming book on family and care, please follow us online and subscribe via the link in bio.